When your icebox is bare, eat the ranch. Show your stomach you care, eat the ranch. Pull the rich ass of the flower, I thank you to shame. Well, and I put all in love, we know who to blame. And I'm tired of being a little loud. Best to forget, eat the rest. Yum, yum, yeah, eat the rest. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food, eat the rest.
Yum, yum, yeah.
But don't you think that that's rude? It's gone, eat the rest.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Bitch ass will flower, I think it's a shame. Spreading out the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of living in the lab. Best to forget, eat the ribs.
Yum, yum,
yum, yeah, eat the ribs.
The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Today we have with us by phone from East Coast, author of a new book called West Bloc Dissident, a Cold War Memoir. Welcome, Bill Bloom.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. This is your return, one of your many visits to the show. And why did you, most people think of East Bloc as dissidents in the East Bloc. Why do you call America the West Bloc?
I chose that title exactly because of that reason, to counterpose the old term East Bloc dissident, to show that it was not only in the Soviet Union that we had people who were not in love with the government and its policies, but as well they were here in the West in large numbers.
So do you see it as kind of broader than just U.S. then?
Broader than
I mean, East Bloc is West Bloc is more than just U.S., right?
Oh well, yeah. Technically, you could say that, but all I have in mind, speaking about myself, is the U.S. This is a personal memoir of somebody, of an American, active in the anti-war movement and against U.S. imperialism in other ways. So it means in this case just the U.S. That's what the book is about, my life as a dissident in and against the U.S. government.
Ah, and so I think was the earlier title anti-CIA war activist or something? Memoir of an anti-CIA war activist?
No.
Because that was somewhere on one of the websites. It seemed to have that as the subtitle.
Oh yeah, I think maybe my publisher had that down as a tentative title. I mean, the book deals with the CIA. To some extent, but that was never my title.
You actually start off talking about the CIA little incident. What paper were you writing for then?
You're speaking of the incident in 1969, where I and somebody else exposed the names of more than 200 employees of the CIA by standing outside CIA headquarters in Virginia. Pretending to have a damaged car.
Flat tire.
And a flat tire. And while I pretended to fix the flat tire, my colleague was speaking into a microphone and recording the license plate numbers of all the cars going into CIA headquarters. And we got hundreds of these numbers, and then later we went to the motor vehicle offices in Washington and in Maryland and Virginia and got the names and addresses of the people to whom the tags belonged, and we published a list of 215 names of these people in the Quicksilver Times, which was a underground newspaper in Washington at that time. And we were told by one reporter from the mainstream press that the CIA had to cancel an overseas assignment for one of the individuals named because his cover had been blown. What the other effects of our list were over the years, I have no idea.
But you actually got in your own files some evidence that they were concerned about it, huh?
Well, it turns out that my partner in this crime was a CIA informant. Whether he was at that moment or he became such later, I still don't know. I would love to know, but I can't find him. But these were real people that we named. I find them all in the phone books of the area.
But you know, just because were they driving into the agency or what?
Yes, this was early in the morning. People were on the way to work, and as we were parked just a few feet off of the turnoff, and any car turning off there, we knew was going into the CIA. And we got a few hundred names and or a few hundred tag numbers, and we published eventually 215 of these people. Just a while ago, for the first time, I met somebody who was a family member of one of those named. He said his father was very angry. His father was in the CIA. He told me his father was very angry. That's the first time in all these years that I've met somebody who was actually affected by the list.
You can't do that again now, huh?
Well, I don't know if it's illegal, actually. Well, yeah, it probably is, because this was in 69, but in 1982, I think it was, the Congress passed a law known commonly as the Philip Agee Law, because it was because of Philip Agee of the CIA, formerly of the CIA, who named names all over the place. They passed a law making it a felony to publish the names of current CIA officers.
If you, it says you can't engage in a pattern of activity that reveals these names.
It would be dangerous. I mean, of course.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, the law says
you know, the Daily Press names these people all the time, but
right.
This law was not aimed at the Daily Press. It was aimed at people like me. It was aimed at dissidents, if you will. And as you know, Covert Action Information Bulletin, which is now called Covert Action Quarterly, they had been in the habit of naming names in every issue, and because of this law in the early 80s, they had to stop that practice.
That's true. Also, you actually went to the DMV in different cities and different states, areas, and you could find out the locations or the information about people.
Yeah.
But now you can't do that.
No,
right?
I imagine so. I imagine everything is tightened up. Actually,
yeah.
It was very easy in Washington. There was a big computer printout on a table in the DMV office, and anyone could walk in and just look at it. There was no formality. And in this day and age of high security, it's hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially in Washington, that you would have it so easy to find out the names of car owners.
Wow, because I think in California there was a case of a murder of an actress, I think. And
right.
So after
I was living in Hollywood when that happened. Yeah, this guy got her name and address from her.
And stalked her, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he murdered her.
Right. You know, Soft Skull Press, why did you go with Soft Skull when your previous books
were Common
about.
Courage Press. Well,
yeah.
I sent them the manuscript to Common Courage. It just wasn't their cup of tea. The editor liked it, but it wasn't his cup of tea. They don't print such things.
They don't like memoirs or what?
No. Soft Skull, as you may know, is much more
daring.
Light, yeah. And they're more offbeat. It's an offbeat book, so that's how I wound up there.
They do a lot of punk rock stuff and literature, kind of you know, what do you call it, at the cutting edge kind of literature and stuff. Like
right,
that.
Right. Somewhat avant-garde. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Are you getting a lot of press about this?
No, I have had one review in the UK.
Huh.
I can't think of anything here. There was an announcement of the book in Z magazine, but it was not a review. That's about it.
It's a fascinating book. I mean, you talk about Oliver Stone among some of the other people that you talk about.
Yeah, well, yeah. That was my...
Maybe you could tell the listeners what that was about.
Hollywood story. This was years later. I moved to Hollywood because Stone wanted to make a documentary film of one of my books on U.S. foreign policy.
This is a book about the CIA?
Yeah, the book, which is now called Killing Hope. At the time, it was called The CIA, A Forgotten History, which was updated to become Killing Hope. This was in 88. Stone wanted to make a film about the book, and I spent 6 months there doing research to find film footage and put the whole thing together, and then Stone had a falling out with his producer, the guy who was paying the bills, and that was the end of the film. That's the kind of thing which happens every day in Hollywood.
Yeah, so, yeah. Who was that? Who was the producer?
Plans fall apart because the two people have an argument.
Who was the producer?
John Daly. He was the head of Hemdale Films. It's a British outfit. And he and Stone had a falling out over the film, over the money concerning the film Platoon, one of Stone's Vietnam films. That was the end of the film.
He couldn't take it on himself?
Well, he didn't. That was the end of it.
What kind of footage were you able to get at that time?
Well, of course, I was actually skeptical of the film itself. I went along with it because I was being paid very well.
Why not? Yeah.
But I told both Stone and Daly that this is it's not the kind of book Hollywood makes films of. It's gonna.
Hollywood,
I said, there's no way to make a film of this book without it sounding or seeming to be unpatriotic. And they didn't care. They went ahead. Well, it was Stone. I mean, it was Stone's idea. I mean, his producer Daly couldn't be less interested in American imperialism. He just was doing a favor to his fair-haired boy Oliver Stone. But once they had a falling out, then he lost his incentive to finance the film. So that's my Hollywood. It's actually a funny story. I mean, I go into all the details, and it's pretty funny.
What is he like? Personally, what do you think of Stone?
Oh well, I didn't become an intimate acquaintance of his. I mean, he. I think he has genuine sympathy for leftist causes.
Yeah.
And he has financed other people on the left in various projects. So, I mean, I respect him.
Yeah, one time he spoke at UCI and I taped his talk and he told me I could sell it or something to finance my cause, I guess.
Yeah.
My causes. But I was leaving for Europe the next day or something, the next week, and I just didn't have time to get it together. And by the time I came back, I forgot about it. So, but I still have the tape somewhere. Yeah. A video, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, a video.
Yeah. So he had given a lecture here, I guess.
Well, I still have much of the footage which I acquired at UCLA to make this documentary film. I still have the footage. I've actually lent it out to other filmmakers who were doing good things.
Yeah. How did you find the footage?
Well, we're talking about secret things now. I mean, U.S. foreign policy and the CIA, their interventions, they were not taped. I mean, I could not find any footage showing the head of the CIA and his assistant plotting the overthrow of the government of Guatemala or Nicaragua or what have you. I can only find footage which was tangential, newsreels showing a coup, showing the aftermath of a coup. So the narrator would have, if the film had been made, the narrator would have given the background to the coup and the U.S. role in it, and then you would have seen the the newsreel, either Fox newsreel or Hearst, showing scenes in the capital of the country where the coup took place and so on. So it would have to be secondary sources. And then there would have been some interviews with people who had something to add to the commentary.
Yeah.
If the film had been made, that is, of course.
You founded the, you are founder of the Washington Free Press in
right.
in Washington.
Right.
DC.
That right. paper was on the verge of being defunct at the time we published our expose, so it was put into the Quicksilver Times.
You put you mentioned it, yes, a chapter in there about the FBI's kind of crackdown on the underground press.
Yeah, you know, in the 60s, people who defended the government and its policies would often point to the underground press as an example of how free the U.S. was. They say, "How could you publishing these newspapers? You know, and that shows that your criticism of the government is unfounded. It's a very free society, and you're making these horrible accusations." But the fact is that the FBI and the police and other authorities did their best to make life very, very difficult for the underground press. I have a whole chapter on all the things the FBI did, and the army. The army broke into our headquarters of the newspaper for all kinds of mischief, and this is all well documented. So they did not respect in any way our freedom to publish our newspaper, and it was the same with other papers of the underground press. The FBI did all kinds of things against these papers.
Did you collect like FBI documents based on about?
Well,
that?
I have my own files. Mm-hmm. I have my own files from the FBI and the CIA and the State Department where I used to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I have extensive files of my own, and that actually inspired the book. I never had any intention or thought of writing of my memoir, but when I began to read these files and I saw the stuff in it, which was not only interesting politically, but funny. Of course, the things they would say about me and my colleagues, which were either wrong or just missed the whole point. And I sat down to write a response to these files, and before I knew it, I was writing my memoir.
Wow.
That's how it began.
That's the way to do it, huh?
It was not any act of egotism that I thought the world had to know about my life. But I think the book is very funny, though.
So. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, people usually think of, you know, I mean, are you also trying to reach this new generation of activists about what went on in the 60s?
Well, hopefully. I mean, I don't have any particular audience in mind. Anyone can read the book, of course, and it's been published by a publishing house which does aim at young people.
Right, definitely.
So that might help to reach them.
And it's in alternative bookstores. You know, their type of bookstores would be like,
yeah, right,
more alternative than Tower, definitely. But,
yeah, I think the people in the current anti-globalization movement probably don't know too much about the 60s and the 70s. You know, the 70s were pretty much similar to the 60s. We speak of the 60s, but almost everything which we associate with that decade applies as well to the 70s, including the war in Vietnam, which lasted until 75.
Do you think activism really died with the end of the protests against the Vietnam War?
With many individuals, yeah. This has been a sad discovery, so to speak, on my part over the years. Many people that I knew personally or knew of who had been very active in the anti-war movement, once the war ended, that was the end of their activism.
Why is that?
They were against the war for all kinds of reasons, like both personal and moral, but not because they saw it as an act of U.S. imperialism and were against imperialism. They had no special ideology along those lines. They were opposed for personal reasons, like the draft of themselves or someone close to them, or they were just turned off very much by the daily pictures on TV and in the press of the napalmed children of Vietnam and things like that.
But they didn't really care about Vietnam since they didn't, you know, stay on and struggle after the war.
I would say they cared about the people of Vietnam. They were upset by the horrible things being done to them. But once the war ended, and the U.S. role, at least when the American role ended, they lost interest in the whole issue. They did not go on to become anti-imperialists, as of course some people did, but most didn't, and many of them actually went into the mainstream. They became all kinds of business people and in advertising, all kinds of things unrelated to anti-imperialism. And I knew many of them. It was a bit sad. I discuss many of these individuals by name in my book, not because I want to attack them. I mean, I'm not nasty about it, I think, but just to give examples of what kind of person changed so much and why they changed, as far as I could tell. I think it's a fascinating phenomenon.
Is it because? Is that just because they were liberals and not anything more than that?
Well, in hindsight, one would have to say that. Yeah, they were liberals. They did not see too much beyond the war itself. Although they could mouth all kinds of slogans. I mean, people learned the slogans. You know, if you went to a demo against the war, there were all kinds of signs and shouting about imperialism, and these people I'm speaking about could hear and read those slogans and repeat them, and they did repeat them, but it was not really an important part of their consciousness. And when the war ended, that was the end of their marching and their sloganeering. I imagine some of them have come back maybe in the 90s to follow the anti globalization movement, but I have no way of knowing that.
But is it because, isn't it part of the problem also that the left didn't create the institutions that supported, you know, people to stay in activism, kind of, I guess. I mean, the people get married, they need jobs, they, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean,
that's a pretty big order to fill. I mean, to actually plan for all these people that when the war ended, they would not be lured by society and money and all that goes with money. That was beyond the means of the left to do that. The power to lure these people into the business world and the universities was too great. Many of them had been pursuing careers anyhow while the war was going on. So when the war ended, they simply continued their careers.
You were in Chile. You lived in Chile.
I went to Chile. I was there in 72 and 73. I wasn't there when the coup took place. I left before the coup took place. But I was there for 8 months. And so I learned and observed quite a bit about what happened there. It was a fascinating experience, and I have a whole chapter on that.
Why did you start it off by talking about, maybe you could explain to your listeners, why mentioning radical psychiatry and Steiner, this guy?
That was one of the many passing fads that I passed through in the 70s and 80s. In Berkeley, it was called radical psychiatry, which was set up to oppose the traditional psychiatry, which blamed the individual for his own psychoses or mental problems. And radical psychiatry attempted to put the blame on society. They would say that people are forced to adjust to societies wishes and needs, and in doing so they can develop certain, all kinds of hang-ups and neuroses and what have you. And so they attempted to show how society, in its basic unfairness and oppressiveness and inequality, how society caused many of these problems in individuals. I toyed with the idea of becoming a so-called radical therapist, but that didn't last too long.
Who was the other, who's the other guy people always cite about this anti-psychiatry movement? You know, the, there's another.
Oh, you mean Thomas Szasz?
Szasz, yeah. Was that the same thing? Or
no, no, he's very different. He's in fact, he's a right winger. he's against the psychiatric establishment.
Oh.
Because he thinks their theories are
crackpot.
Baloney.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And, but he's no.
But politically, he's a right winger, you mean?
Yeah, politically, he's very conservative.
Oh, I didn't know that.
A conservative anti-communist.
Huh.
Yeah.
But this was right before you went to Chile, then. Why did you go there?
Well, to observe what was taking place, there was a very exciting thing. It was a socialist experiment in the past. In the 20th century, the U.S. government, in almost every case of a serious attempt at creating a socialist society anywhere in the world, in almost every case, the U.S. government has intervened to destabilize and attack and invade and bomb and or otherwise make life impossible for such societies. Of course, the one thing the U.S. government feared and still fears the most is the rise of a good example to challenge the capitalist model of society. And that's why they're still so hostile to Cuba, because Cuba, in their minds, still represents a possible good model as an alternative to the capitalist system. Of course, having made life so difficult for Cuba, they've guaranteed that the model, the example, would not be as great as it might otherwise have been. And that's what they've done all over the world in the entire 20th century, starting with the invasion of the Soviet Union. And how many Americans are aware of that?
That right.
14 Western nations, well, including Japan, actually, invaded the newly born Soviet Union, and just to make sure that that infant would grow up in a deformed manner, and they succeeded.
You know, I saw there was this film about the Allende days, right? What was that film called? History and Memory. What's that?
You mean a feature film?
Yeah.
Missing.
No. This is a not Hollywood, but more kind of progressive film about Allende's days. And then he went back. I forget the director's name, but he went back to Chile. It's about the rise of Allende and his death. And then he went back and filmed the death of. He did another film like 10 years or 20 years later.
Are you speaking of Sol Landau or Mark Cooper?
No. It's a Latin American. And he, anyway, he came back and he filmed it like after the junta had taken over. And he found that the people thought, he interviewed people, and the people thought Allende was a bad guy. And so, you know, it depends on how history is constructed.
Well, it depends on who you speak to.
I mean,
that's the same in any society. You're going to find any leader is going to have a certain portion of the population against him. But in the last election, prior to the coup, the coalition of which Allende was part of received over 44% of the vote against the opposition, which the anti-Allende opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a sizable plurality, and that set the coup in motion, because the right wing realized that they would never get rid of Allende and his party legally or through elections. They realized then that they would have to use force. His popularity was growing. His vote then was higher than it was in the prior election. So they knew there was no chance of doing it except through a coup. But of course, it was easy to find people who were opposed to him, especially the middle and upper classes. He was a candidate for the many poor people.
What did you do there then? Maybe you could explain.
What did I do in Chile?
Yeah.
Well, I was writing for two news agencies back in the States, Dispatch News Service in Washington, which was its most famous for having exposed the
My Lai
massacre, and Alternate Features Service of Berkeley. So I was writing for those two agencies.
Do they, are both of them, they're not around anymore, huh?
No. Long gone.
Do you know what happened to the archives or whatever?
Their archives, no. I have no idea.
Yeah, that one time I got these stacks of Liberation News Service.
LNS may still exist. I think they do, in fact.
Really?
Yeah, they have been around a long, long time. I wrote for them a lot.
Well, I thought they ended because I got all these hundreds of issues one time, and because they were closing, I guess, or something.
No, I know. As of a few years ago, they were still publishing.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, maybe you're thinking of the big split which took place in 69 between two factions of LNS. That caused a temporary halt to the publication. But
no, this was back
soon,
in the...
Soon renewed.
I think this was late 70s or 80s. Mid-80s, I think, when I got several boxes of these.
But oh, you mean under FOIA?
No. This was... this I got it from a... They had extra copies, I guess, some library, and they gave them to me.
I actually applied, excuse me, and got a large box full of the FBI files on Liberation News Service.
Ah.
Yeah, if anyone, any of your listeners has a good use for them, they should contact me.
How many pages is that? You think? Oh, whole box.
Hundreds.
How about your own file? How big was that? From the various
agencies. Well, from all three of those agencies I mentioned, was not huge. Maybe, a few hundred pages in total.
What was the CIA one like? Was that
They knew.
All blacked out.
They knew that I had taken part in this expose. I mean, we didn't have bylines under the story that we published, which gave the name. So, but they knew that was me. They were mistaken about certain of the details. They thought that my partner had been marking down by hand these tag numbers, but he was actually speaking them into a microphone. They were off by quite a few details.
Yeah, they thought he was writing it on a newspaper.
Yeah, that's what they thought, right.
You mentioned that they didn't seize the newspaper because they thought it would be illegal.
they didn't
confiscate
the newspaper, because they were in Virginia. They were off their own grounds, and I comment about the irony. The CIA was so concerned about the niceties of Virginia law, but at the very same time, in Washington, they were breaking into foreign embassies to steal documents. So much for their obeisance to the law.
That's true. Whenever it's convenient, they would.
Well, they're more afraid of their
exposés.
Domestic authorities than they are of anyone abroad.
That's true. We're talking with William Bloom, who's the author of a new book called West Block Dissident from Soft Scout Press. And Soft Scout is www.softscout.com.
Can I mention my own email address if anyone wants to contact me about this book or any of my other books?
Email or web address?
My email is
email, sorry. Yeah.
It's bblum6@aol.com.
There's so many Blooms there.
No. They told me I had to choose a number. I don't know if there were five other B Blooms, but.
Did you self-censor when you were writing this book? I mean, people always think about, that it's like tell-all memoir, but maybe you...
Yeah,
you
well, the hardest part was to know what to include and what not to include. I mean, some things I included, I think, I've had second thoughts about, because I'm not sure anyone is interested in such personal
detail
stuff, but
Yeah.
I was pretty open about it.
You talk about the relationships you had or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. And I tried to keep it as political as I could, but then I kept thinking that the reader would like to know more about my personal life, and so I kept including more and more things. And so it came out to be a memoir which is mainly political, but it's also a lot personal.
But how do you keep your sanity if, you know, if like somebody you're attracted to turns out to be a CIA informant?
Well, in this case, the guy who was with me on this expose thing, he was a very close friend.
Uh-huh.
It was a shock, a big shock to find out. And I've been looking for him ever since. I want to ask him when he was turned. I mean, I want to know whether he was with the agency at the same time that he knew me, or did his change come later? And I can't find, he's changed his name. If anyone out in California, and last I knew he was living in California, if anyone knows of an Alan Vincent Carter, that's my former friend. Tell him that I don't want to hurt him. I just want to talk to him.
Yeah.
There won't be any problem.
That's scary. But how long were you friends then? Like,
we were friends for a year and a half, but it was intimate. Mm-hmm. We saw each other every day for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We were almost neighbors, and we were active in all kinds of things. And so it was a big shock to me.
So how did you find out then? Maybe you could tell your listeners.
Well,
listeners.
I found out about him, but his name, his real name is Sal Ferreira.
Right.
And when I knew him, that's what I knew him as. I found out about him from Philip Agee's book,
mm-hmm.
Agee's first book. His
CIA diary.
The company, CIA diary, yeah. Inside the company.
Inside the company, yeah.
Yeah. I was very shocked when I read that book.
The Penguin.
I came upon my friends.
He was also in the underground press, right? Yeah.
Yes, he was very. He was using underground press as his cover, in the States and in Paris, and for several years. And it was a big shock to many people who had worked with him to find out what were his loyalties actually lay.
Was he the one that planted the microphone in the typewriter for?
Yes. On the cover of Agee's book,
right.
in the
Penguin
edition,
a picture
of a typewriter,
yeah.
with the cloth of inside the back cover
ripped off,
hanging loose, and you can see behind the cloth there was a transmitter. And this was given to Agee as a gift in Paris by Sal and his girlfriend,
right.
And for Agee to use while he was writing this book. And but the purpose of the gift was to allow the CIA to find out where Agee was living and working, because they didn't know. And so they used the transmitter hidden in the typewriter to track him down in Paris, and then that they haunted him in Paris and in London.
So you knew him before this happened, before he planted.
I didn't meet Agee until his book came out.
No, I meant Sal.
Oh, Sal. Yeah, you're right. I knew Sal in Washington in '69 and
'70.
The last time I saw him was in 1973, in Paris. He was living there, and I was passing through.
Mm.
I had no idea then of his secret background. That was 73, and then Agee's book came out at the end of 74, in which he exposed Sal, but I could not find Sal anymore. I did find out that he changed his name. You know, we were speaking before of how easy it was to obtain the information from the DMVs, and how that thing has probably changed. Back in 10 years ago or so, I just called up the government of the city of Chicago and was told over the phone what name Sal had used to change his name. On the phone, they told me what his new name was. It's amazing how loose things were then. And today, it's the far opposite.
Although I suppose you could go on LexisNexis, and Lexis has a kind of personal ID kind of database, and you can search that, and it would.
Search for, well, Well, I've searched for Sal, under his new name and his old name and under various databases.
Huh.
Not under. Tell me about Lexus. I have Lexus, but I don't.
Well, it's. I think it's the full version. It's not the. I mean, the a lot of libraries have academic version, but there's another version I think that has all these other databases.
And what do they have, which you can't find with a personal search?
Maybe it's
on the
it's more like. It would be tied into either court records or, well, maybe court records are probably, but it's, I'm not sure if it's real estate records or some other records that you could actually find, like social security numbers.
Oh, well, that's used by various investigating agencies.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
no.
Who sell their services. They have access to all kinds of records.
Right.
Yeah,
you get what you know on the web. You get all these emails saying.
Right. And if I was sure that they could find him for me, I'd be willing to pay them something.
Pay
but they don't guarantee. Yeah. So I don't feel like paying them a fee and then being told that they can't find him.
Oh yeah, that's true. But what? Why is this need to meet up with old acquaintances?
Well, as I mentioned, I want to know when it was that he. And he switched allegiances. It's not just a personal thing. It's I want to know how the CIA works and how what they use to turn him. You know, this is very important information to know how they work in such cases.
Do you think he'll be willing to talk if you?
Well, unless he thinks I'm going to hurt him, I mean, which I'm not going to. I have no such intention. We might even have a good laugh. For all I know.
Yeah.
After the first few minutes of a tense meeting, we might even start talking about old times, when we used to laugh a lot.
How do you keep your sanity? I mean, in terms of not get paranoid, I guess.
That's too late for that. I mean, anyone who's an activist has to be paranoid. I mean, I mention him in my book. Several people besides Sal, who are informers and agents.
Right.
You can't be an activist and not be conscious of that. That's suicide.
Well, I used to know. O'Donnell. I think Sheila O'Donnell. Do you know her? She used to say there was such a thing as healthy paranoia, for activists to kind of not be totally paranoid, but to be healthy.
Yeah, of course.
Paranoid.
You have to weigh what somebody says and wonder how they know it and not be afraid to ask them questions. You know, people are embarrassed to question their colleagues in the movement, but you have to.
Yeah, I mean, you don't watch over your shoulders all the time.
No, never.
Never.
I don't even worry about my phone being tapped, although it may be. But I don't think about such things. But I do wonder about people I meet and people I read.
Oh, yeah. How about in terms of personal relationships? Do you find it hard to have a personal relationship if somebody might be there to spy on you, I mean, whatever?
No, I haven't had that experience. I mean, the people I meet who I want to become friends with, I don't shy away from becoming friends with people because I wonder about them in that context.
Is it more politics that come into play there, or rather than, oh no?
Well, it's political, yeah. I want to
know
how this phenomenon works. It's important for anyone who's an activist to know as much about how the other side recruits and uses informers.
How did you, how about just in terms of getting paid, when you're writing for these alternative news agencies, underground news agencies, when you were in Chile, for instance,
they paid small amounts of money.
Yeah, was that sufficient to?
Well, because the cost of living was much less in Chile than it was here.
Right, right.
My whole career with the underground press was like that. I was published many, many times, but I was paid very small amounts. But it was very nice, and it led me into much better paying writing later on.
Is it? Did you ever consider, or did, when you were writing this memoir, did you consider doing an anthology of all your previous work?
No, I mean,
that would be. Nobody would want to.
I mean, if a major publisher came to me and made me a great offer to do that, I'd say okay. You know, but otherwise, I would almost be embarrassed.
But you don't think, why embarrass?
It's kind of egotistical. I mean, it was bad enough to write my memoir, but I don't want to just have, you mean the best of Bill Bloom?
But I mean, you know, I was thinking more in terms of, it would give a little context, you know, because it's kind of contemporary literature at the time these things were happening. But, you know, most people today probably don't kind of can't get the feel of what it was like then. And so...
On my website, I have selected chapters of my books, and I have many essays of mine apart from the books. So if anyone wants to get a taste of what you're talking about, they can go to my website. And if they write to me at the email address I gave before, I'll give them the addresses.
So you don't feel like, you had to overcome this thing, and did you feel like it was arrogant to write your own book?
Well, as I mentioned, it began because of my files, my government files, and I began just to write a response to those files, and then before I knew it, I was writing a memoir. But in hindsight, I mean, at some point, I did wonder about it. I mean, because I had never really planned on doing my life story. I didn't.
Were you embarrassed to tell people about it, or no?
Some things.
Why was going on?
Something after the book came out, when I read some sections of it, I was a bit taken aback myself, thinking I was a bit too open. I could have not have mentioned that, especially about some social relations.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people I criticized on the left, and I may hear from some of them.
Did you criticize yourself? Or did you try it?
Well, yeah, there are things. There are all kinds of things in the book which are self-critical. Nothing major.
Do you regret? I mean, I asked this of Bill Ayers wrote a memoir.
Oh, yeah?
He was on the
show. Right. I've seen it.
Yeah, he was on the show before, and he... I mean, there's certain things he didn't like about his own life, you know, the way he acted and stuff. But he basically continued to be active.
My book is not a full-fledged autobiography by any means. It is basically a political memoir where I throw in all kinds of personal things for each period I'm speaking about. But it's essentially a political memoir. It's a history of the times that I lived in, mainly the 60s and 70s, but also later on also, as well. But it's not really a full-fledged autobiography.
At this point, do you still want to write? Want to write for the an alternative publication? I know you worked at Covert.
I've graduated from that. If you speak of the kinds of papers from the 60s and 70s, I couldn't live on that. I have to make more money now than I did then.
But in the 90s, you worked for Covert Action, and
but that was just as a sideline. I mean, they actually paid more than any of the other so-called alternative publications. But I'm looking. I mean, I've made my most of my money in recent years from my books. So the stuff I've done for magazines has been secondary.
So you're going to plan to write more then?
Well, yeah, books. I'm not retired. I don't know if I have any more books in me on U.S. foreign policy. I'm a bit burnt out on that score, especially since people always want to know what my solution is. How do I stop the American empire? And I have no good answer. And what I've been doing so far is just cataloging what the empire has done with no means expressed by me as to how to stop the empire, and people want solutions, and I don't have one. So I don't know if I'll be doing any more books on U.S. foreign policy until I come up with a solution.
But you do have catchy titles. I mean, the last one was Rogue State, and before that, Killing Hope. And
having a catchy title isn't. Reason enough to do a book.
Did you come up with those titles on the...
Yeah, those are my titles.
So like two-word titles, although this one's more than that, but...
Yeah. Well, my West Block Dissident is three words, unless...
Oh, I see.
But the first one is a hyphenated, so maybe it's also two words.
Right. You said it was reviewed abroad. What in England or what?
Yeah, only by a magazine which you are familiar with, I'm sure. Gloucester magazine in the UK had a long review of it.
Gloucester?
Ramsey.
Lobster.
Lobster magazine.
Oh, right. Anti-surveillance, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. It's kind of obscure to people other than...
I think we actually have it here.
You and my, your type and my type.
I think we have it. We may have it here at the library.
Oh, yeah.
So you might check it out.
So now it's come. The same review is going to be done in what used to be known as North Coast Express from Northern California, which has now had a change of name. I think it's called Justice Express or something like that.
Huh.
It's going to be in there. Otherwise, it's been in an obscure, a review of the book was in an obscure magazine in Canada by someone I know from the internet. Besides that, I don't know of any reviews. Certainly, it's not going to be in the Washington Post or the New York Times.
I figured, you know, like Sofsky actually does really beautiful books. I mean, I know that some of the books are smaller size, you know, the literature ones, but the covers are really pretty. I like the design and the colors.
Yeah, my cover is good. It's nice. It
right,
shows,
too.
Shows a,
also,
shows
yeah.
a major demo against the war in Vietnam.
I was looking for you in the demo, but I guess
no,
not a
it.
Picture of
no,
yourself.
No. I got that from somebody who is in the picture.
Oh. And do you have any... I mean, if somebody... was we went to you for advice, would you tell them write a book or not about their lives? I mean,
advice of what kind?
I mean, if they asked you whether they should do a memoir.
No, well, why would anyone ask me that?
Since you already did one.
I mean, that's a decision for the individual to make. I can't tell them to they should write their own memoir.
That's true.
I can't imagine anybody would ask me that, even. Is that you're thinking about? Are you thinking about doing that?
No, somebody did ask me to write about my case, you know, my own file case, I guess.
Oh.
But, I mean, they...
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I have so
okay.
busy. I mean, I'm just too busy. I have no time to write like that.
Your memoir might be interesting.
I don't know.
I know things about you, yeah.
I'm getting interesting from... no, I mean, you're giving me some ideas, but I've been going to some literary readings, and they... A lot of people mix literature with reality, you know, like narrative writing. They create some. Maybe it'll be easier to write a fictional account of reality that you could say anything you want, I guess.
Well, you mean a novel? Yeah,
no, but base it on loosely on some
the whole context.
Oh, I see. But I mean a real life the story based on your life, but then you could make it semi. Fictional or
no, I tried my hand at novels in the past, and they've been terrible. So I think I'll stick to nonfiction from now on.
Yeah, I think it's hard to, you know. I mean, it's really a different. Although there's this crossover, I think, when you write narrative that is actually sounds like it's real, but it's actually some of it's kind of fictionalized.
Well, my memoir is full of all kinds of narratives, of incidents and in my life political movements and so on, which I hope are written in a light.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Novelistic fashion. I think the book is readable.
What? Maybe you could tell your listeners what was it? The Vietnam War that basically drove you from the State Department? And,
yeah, right. Yeah. I was working at the State Department, planning to be a foreign service officer, and a thing called Vietnam came along and changed my mind completely. And
were you planning to go abroad?
I was planning to become, well, if I had been a foreign service officer, of course, I would have been sent abroad. That was the whole idea.
What country were you interested
in? To serve abroad.
What country were you interested in at that time?
Well, I didn't, no. To have such thoughts would have been very premature. I first had to pass the test to become an FSO, and then I would have gone through training, and then I would have been sent to some embassy.
Were they screening out, like, leftists at the time? Or, oh, you weren't that active then, or what?
Oh, I was a good liberal anti-communist. I mean, why else would I have wanted to be a foreign service officer?
I don't know.
Of course, I supported the U.S. foreign policy, and that was clear. It didn't change overnight, but the war changed me very sharply.
Definitely, yeah. So what do you think about, since 9/11, whether... do you think it's are people still resisting, you think, in terms of these civil liberties violations?
Well, I think the left was in a state of shock for the first few months after 9/11. The crackdown on civil liberties was so heavy and in so many ways that people were just afraid. And when, of course, at the same time, all the flag waving and all the patriotism, people were just afraid to say anything which might be taken to be unpatriotic. But that's finally beyond to wear off, and people are acting back now, acting up. And it's no telling where it'll go, but I think the fear is over. They're questioning the whole war on terrorism.
Because it hasn't gained any results? Or?
Well, who wants it to gain results? It's so oppressive. I mean, that isn't the issue, that it hasn't worked. I don't want it to work in the sense of the way it's being carried out.
But I mean, other people, I mean, the broader society, don't you think the right is also now questioning Bush's attacks? They say they're upset over his Ashcroft, for instance, and stuff like that. Or they're upset over Ashcroft going too far?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. When it comes to civil liberties, people on the right can often be more progressive than liberals. Liberals tend to be often the strongest supporters of U.S. foreign policy, and it's very ironic.
Well, they act scared, I guess. So they would.
Liberals are more afraid of being called unpatriotic than people on the right are. So that's why a liberal will right. be more cautious.
I guess we're out of time. It's 5 o'clock here. Thank you, William Bloom.
Thank you, Daniel.
Being on the show.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. That was William Bloom of West Bloc Dissident from South Soft Skull Press. This is Dan Sung signing off for Subversity. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California nor the management of KUCI. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.